Testing, okay. Good evening, everybody. So as usual, I start a bit early. Today really feel people. Death is very powerful. A dispelling people. Anyway, as usual, I start a few minutes early. See if anybody has any questions. You found what is the mantra?
No, which mantra did you find?
Have you found it? What? Oh, Mandrushi mantra. Yeah. So I told this story last week about Western Buddhist scholar and practitioner Jeffrey Hawking, how he was about to die, you know, he from complication from Lyme disease, and as he go through a dissolution process, the dying process, then he suddenly this mantra that was taught to him by his teacher popped into his mind, and then the dying process reversed itself and he came back to life. Yeah. So that's a Mandrushi mantra. Yeah. Does not always work well. When it's time to go, then it's time to go. So just now someone asked me a question about attachment to someone close to you, you know. So if you feel you have strong feelings for a loved one and you have a lot of attachment to them, then how do we somehow work with that attachment, lessen that attachment? And I think maybe that is also relevant to today's topic on death, because so death or dying is a context in which also brought forth the strong feelings of attachment, right? Be it our sense of loss towards someone who is dying, or maybe the other way around, we are the one dying and we feel great attachment to those that we are about to leave behind. So there's also a context in which attachment can arise strongly for those that are close to us. Now, this kind of attachment you'll find in the teaching. Buddhist teaching tends to talk about when you counter attachment, you meditate on what's called ugliness or non-attractiveness. But that attachment in those contexts are primarily related to attachment or attraction to the beauty of the body, which is why you meditate on, you know, the so-called non-attractiveness of the body. But when it comes to like someone that you love, so it's not so much a sexual attraction, but it's your feeling of love, so-called care and concern of those close to you. And also, probably embedded within it is also the sense that your happiness and their happiness are somehow intertwined together. Right? So there is this great longing to be close to them. Yeah. So the physical proximity with the loved one is somehow in our mind is equated with happiness, primarily our own happiness, because they probably are quite happy on their somewhere. So that kind of attachment is quite difficult, because it's very much very closely related to love, our love for this person and also our attachment to this person. And quite often when I present this Buddhism, when it comes to this topic, a lot of people say, oh, I can't possibly love without attachment. That's an interesting thing. People feel that if they don't feel this attached, they don't feel that they need to hang on to the person, then they cannot be loved. Yeah. So one of the challenge when you want to try to diminish that attachment is you must be able to separate the two. You must separate attachment from towards the person, from love towards the person, so that you, in your mind, you can come to an understanding that I can still love this person, still care and be concerned of this person, without the other feeling of attachment, of clinging, trying to hold on to them, or keep them close to us. you must be able to separate the two. If you cannot make the distinction, then of course it becomes very difficult to let go of them physically. Yeah. Because you feel that we really need them to be close by. And so one way to work on that, there are many ways. First is to work on the feeling, the sense of loving kindness towards this person, to strengthen the loving kindness towards this person, so that you actually have a very clear sense of what it means to love those close ones. What do I really mean when I say I love you? No. I love you, therefore you must stay near me. I love you, and if you are happy, you can be anywhere in the world. So, to clarify for ourselves, what does it really mean to love somebody? So that's one thing we can do, is to actually cultivate loving kindness towards our close ones. It sounds very strange. Actually, a lot of time when we say I love you, probably has very little to do with love. It has a lot to do with attachment. Oh, because you make me feel happy, therefore you should hang around. You know, and if you love me, you should do this. You should not do that. Okay, so what we call love, quite often, is not really love. It's a lot of attachment. Because you make me feel happy, you make me feel important, you reassured me, you comfort me. Actually, a lot of me. Yeah. So a lot of actually self-love as opposed to love for the person. So one way we can work on this attachment issue is to really, you know, work on love. If the person you love is happier away from you, will you be able to let them be or not? Yeah. So that's one thing to do. The other thing is to really work on really identify when is it that I'm experiencing the feeling of love, and when it is the feeling of attachment. Right? Attachment, Lama Zopa Rinpoche has a book called The Door to Satisfaction. Yeah. So in that book, it's an old book, talk a lot about attachment and how we confuse attachment with love. And the attachment is compared quite often in teaching as a razor blade that is smeared with honey. So you lick it because it tastes nice, but hidden in the nice sweet taste of honey is a sharp blade that will cut you. So, and that's often what happens with attachment. Attachment has a lot to do with you experience a lot of pleasant sensation when you are with a person. So it felt very nice, but embedded with it is the source of great pain. Because then if the person didn't call you back, or they didn't message you back, receive, how come no reply? No, receive and open, how come no reply? Then you get very, something's wrong. A kind of feeling that sometimes I find it kind of exciting, but other times it's very, it's actually agitating. So when we clearly see the drawback of the mind of attachment, how actually attachment really make us suffer. You know, but it doesn't actually make you closer to the person. It doesn't really express your, in fact, sometimes attachment when it expressed as very clingy, you know, like cling. Oh, how come you didn't message me back? How come you didn't call me back? How come you didn't stay around? Then the other person, the one that's been loved, felt like, like suffocated. Yeah. So actually for them, the so-called love is a source of great distress and suffering. Right? So the other way to work on this kind of, in the case of close, very close relationship, to work on attachment is to really see how certain states of mind that we may confuse as love and concern are really attachment, are really a bit like hanging on to it, clinging onto them, and a lot of self involved about me. And also, it's actually a state of great distress and suffering. And so you contrast the two. When you meditate on loving kindness for this person, it felt very nice, right? And the love is very giving, very open. There is a great sense of warmth, of sharing, you know, and love, in a sense, liberate the other person, liberate yourself and also liberate the other person. And then you contrast it with when you contemplate, you notice attachment. It has a very kind of, although it may feel pleasant or exciting at some moments, but other moments it's tormenting, it's very distressing, and it's really like, you feel like, oh, I really don't want it. So this is a very classic Buddhist strategy. If you have, you set up a contrast between what is good and virtuous and pleasant and helpful, and what is the opposite of it, which is the disadvantages, the drawback, the painfulness, the suffering of it. And so when you provide this contrast to your mind, over a period of time with repetition, what you're trying to do is you're trying to get your mind, your attention, to draw away from this and put its energy into the other one. Right? So then over a period of time, there's a shift happens. Right? So the shift, hopefully in this case, is towards greater sense of love and kindness and care and concern and less of the attachment to it. Then over a period of time, you might one day realize that you're happy to be with this person, you feel a sense of warmth and love. And then when you are not physically with the person, there is no, the old feeling of attachment and clinging no longer arise. And then you know that you have managed to strengthen the love and weaken the attachment. So this is one way we can work on attachment. Okay, so let's start on, this is the last class of this series, called Appreciating Your Life and Death. So, previous sessions I have covered, appreciating our precious human life. So we, take some time to reflect and try to recognize the precious quality of our human life, try to appreciate the wonderful and auspicious features of this life, and also to recognize how rare and unique, our life is very unique because it's the only one, right? Our life is unique to ourselves with its own unique conditions, causes and conditions, right? So this life is precious, it's rare, and it's very has great potential, great possibilities. So it's also good to reflect on with this life what we can accomplish, what we can achieve, or what we already have achieved and what we can achieve in the future. So the whole idea is to develop a sense of appreciation towards our own life, having a very good kind of, it's like you evaluate your life in a very positive light, and you come away from it feeling very uplifted, feeling very encouraged, and feeling that you really cherish your own life because you see the value in it, you see how wonderful it is, and you also can appreciate its potential. So that is the first part that we talk about. And I always joke that it's a bit too positive for a pessimist. I mean, I'm a confirmed pessimist. If you ever tell me your wonderful project, I can guarantee you the first thought that popped into my mind is, oh, what happens if it fails? What can possibly go wrong? And Murphy's law, right? Whatever can possibly go wrong will most probably go wrong. Yeah? So I always start from the worst case scenario, and then you give me time, I will eventually work my way up to the better scenario, but I always start from the worst case. If you can handle the worst case, then everything else will be better. Right? Okay. So, But over the years, I think even for a pessimist, if you keep thinking about it, you reflect, you try to unearth, I call it the gems of your own life, you can come to see the positive aspects of life. Of course, we all have our own challenges, our own disappointment, sadness, unfortunate circumstances. Yeah. So this kind of reflection, it's simply asking you to highlight what is the positive, what is the auspiciousness of your life, right? Then the second half of it, we have been talking about death awareness. And I mentioned, and I'll mention again, death awareness is reflecting on the fact that we are all going to die. It's not meant to stir up fear. Although fear occasionally may arise if we start to think about death, the whole purpose of all this is not to make you afraid. It's not to frighten you. It's not like going to see this horror movie, you know, that you hide behind your hand and yet you still want to watch it, you know, because it's kind of adrenaline inducing, you know, any moment you know, you are going to be shocked and yet you still make yourself go through it. I never understand people. I don't watch horror movies. Okay? The one that every moment you felt like your heart is going to stop. And yet we do it, right? Now, death awareness meditation is not a horror movie, okay? It's not meant to watch it, to scare yourself to death, okay? And it's not meant to, also don't meditate in such a way that stirs up fear, you know, purposely stirs up fear. Although occasionally you can touch something and some strong emotions can arise, you know, in relation to the topic of death. But that's not the purpose, right? The purpose is to actually bring this fact of life into our awareness. Instead of avoiding death, instead of thinking of anything related to it as taboo, to actually, you know, address it, to actually bring it into awareness, you'll find that it deprives the topic of death a lot of its power over you, a lot of actually just by being exposed to the idea of death over a period of time, it becomes, it normalizes. You know? You actually find that, oh, of course, if I'm born, then of course I'm die. Now, birth and death are just two sides of the same coin, the coin of life. Right? It's not possible to have life without death. So it's just a normal fact. And by being exposed to it, it normalizes it and allows you to actually mainly prepare you for death. Not just your own death, but also death that happens around you. Yeah. Okay, so the last two sessions and today, when we're going to talk about death and we'll meditate on it, it's not meant to frighten us. It's not meant to stir that fear. Okay? But instead, it's to get us to become more, to acknowledge this fact of life and to be more prepared for it and to be able to live our life in a better way, in the light of awareness of death. And so that's the purpose. So previously I have explained and we have meditated on this 9-point meditation on death, which is sort of come under three sections. The first section is related to really coming to understand or to know that we are all definitely going to die, or I am definitely going to die. There's no way I can escape my own death, and every passing day, every passing hour, minute, I'm coming closer and closer to my own death. I'm moving closer towards it, and in spite of that, at the moment, I'm still not spending a lot of time preparing for it in the spiritual sense, mental sense. I'm not giving it enough of importance. Yeah. So because of that, I probably maybe wasting my life quite a lot of ways. I'm still wasting my life. But that's alright. You don't have to be perfect. Yeah. But so this first 3 points is related to coming to acknowledge that I'm definitely going to die. So it's important to, some point in time, it's important to address it, you know, and to figure out the causes and really face up to it. Then the second 3 points, second step, is related to the uncertainty of the time of death. When I'm going to die, I don't know. I just know. Because the 3 points are the lifespan, our lifespan, human lifespan, are uncertain, are varied. You know, some people live for a very long time, some people live for a very short time. And there's no, we don't come with a label and say expiry date is this. But there was a movie where I think there is a counter on the body. They count down the number of hours and minutes towards your aspiring. Yeah. And the whole idea of that movie. I never watch it. I think it's to increase the, you can reset it or you can increase it. Yeah. Unfortunately, although we do have a counter, it's not visible. We don't know when it expires. Yeah. Okay. So our lifespan is not fixed. There are many causes of death. These are not a reason for not living home. It's just to be aware that actually many things can lead to our death. Even those that are supposed to sustain our life in certain occasions becomes the cause of our death. So food is supposed to sustain our life, but we can also die from food poisoning. But medicine is supposed to help us to heal, to get better, but occasionally medicine can kill us. So and the last point is that our body is actually quite fragile from a certain point of view. Yeah. So if it just the right or the wrong blood vessel was burst, and then that's the end of our life. So it heightens the sense of how fragile our life is, and therefore they hope to create a sense of urgency. Not urgency in the sense of anxiety, but urgency in the sense to recognize that almost that every day is precious, so every moment if you can. You know. And sometimes it's very good to think in this way in relation to people close to us, to feel that each time we see them, each time we get to be with them, and then we say goodbye, and that goodbye could be the last one. So now that you have this chance to be with them, why not give this person your full attention? Why not really enjoy one another's company, you know, and to really appreciate the fact that you have this opportunity to spend time together? Because quite often we take things for granted, right? Same old thing, same old person, same old setting, same old conversation. So we tend to be half-hearted. We don't really pay attention to one another. And then suddenly you realize, this person is gone. Death has struck. This person is gone from your life. And there's nothing else you can do. You cannot rewind the clock. So the awareness of the uncertainty of the time of death can help you to be more appreciative of what you enjoy at this moment, who you have with you at this moment, to appreciate them. Appreciate their presence in your life. So this is difficult to realize. This second point is not about uncertainty of time. It's difficult to realize because we have naturally within our mind or brain, we have this tendency to sort of forget about it. I told this story that one moment I'm like less than half a meter away from death at the traffic light, and this truck that went zoom across me. If I were to step up 1 second early, I'll be dead, right? So that is a reminder that I could be dead at any moment. And yet, it doesn't take long for me to forget about that incident. The shock of that incident lasts only a few seconds. And then the routine of life take over again. I have forgotten about that. So that's how easy we we settle back into old routine. We settle back into very habituated pattern of behavior, and we quite often involve not paying attention, or very half-heartedly, we take people around us for granted. We take our circumstances for granted. We take our food for granted. Until you go on a fast, then you really appreciate your food. Right, the time when you cannot eat. You wear on those fasting hours, and you cannot drink, and then you really appreciate. You really notice water around. There's water here, there's water there, there's water on the altar. When you're I was doing this new name, this fasting retreat, in someone's place, wherever somebody got this place, and someone has so generously offered this plate of, I think it must be peach. Those that smell. Really, really sweet. Wow. I think the whole retreat, I've been prostrating to this kitchen. Because it's right in front of me, and I can smell it, and I prostrate. I'm quite sure I did visualize Kuan Yin. It's always a bit difficult, like 1,000 miles difficult. But that peach, frustrating. And sometimes you get this fantasy, right? You say, I will eat one as breakfast, as breakfast. I used to do this when I was fasting retreat. Instead of meditating on Kuan Yin, light pouring down, I would plan my menu for the day I breakfast. First must be watermelon juice. Then I would eat this, I would drink that. A lot of things to do with drinking. Because I was dehydrated, right? Thirsty, right? And then when you meditate, right, instead of Kuan Yin appear, you know, then a hamburger will appear. The hamburger looks very real, you know. I said, wow, I really can visualize. It comes spontaneously to mind, you know. Then you realize, oh, I should have faith in myself. I can visualize. Just the hamburger looks really, really real, you know. So how powerful is human desire in this case? So it's when I cannot eat and I cannot drink, suddenly I really appreciate, you know, the opportunity to eat and drink. You understand? That's how sad we human beings are. When the things are, we are surrounded by them, we don't appreciate it. When they're all gone, then we say, oh, I really missed it. Yeah. So it's good, you know, with this practice of awareness of death that we at least know sometimes we can pause a bit. We can appreciate the things around us, the people around us, and that, you know, there are occasions where instead of thinking about other things like me, I'm supposed to meditate on Kuan Yin, without compassion, then I would think of something else. We get distracted, but maybe we can come back and give our full attention to those people closest to us, those people that we profess to love. In Singapore culture, maybe we don't have a culture of saying, oh, I love you. Like my mother never said, I love you. Yeah. But quite often the love is expressed through action, through behavior. Yeah. So maybe we can also, you know, give some attention to that and see if we can also express our loving concern and our cherishing of those around us through our action, through our behavior, through even just willing to pay attention to them when they are talking. So that is one of the benefits of death awareness. So the last 3 points is to do with dying, which we are going to visit today. We're going to practice dying today. Don't worry, right? Please don't die, right? Don't die on me. Police report and ambulance and all these things. Quite complicated. Right? Stay alive. Okay? The last 3 points is related to dying. What is most helpful to us? What can we really rely on at the point of dying? Those things that we have always relied on throughout our life, at that point, at that moment of dying, suddenly they are not as important or not as powerful anymore. Our material possessions, our money, which are very helpful, no denial of it. You know, maybe at the point of dying, they are no longer so meaningful, so important. And in fact, they can, depending on how attached you are to them, they may actually disturb your mind. I don't want that person to get my house. I must make sure they cannot get my house. I must do it. So there you are, dying, and you're worried about who's going to get hold of your material possession. So it disturbs your mind instead of giving you peace. Right? So material possession not going to help us. Our loved ones are also not able to help us. So I always joke about this. I was young when we watched. These days they don't do it so dramatic. In the old days, when you watch those old Cantonese soap opera drama, they like to show this poor soul is dying on the bed, right? And there'll be people crying and say, please don't go, please don't die. I always felt that so unfair to the dying person, right? The person should sit down and say, look, I don't want to go, but I can't help it, right? I'm the one dying. Okay, please shut up. Okay, so how distressing it is when you are the one dying and someone was telling you, please don't go. I didn't choose to go. I didn't want to go. Right. So people that closest to you can at the time of dying be the one that really agitates your mind. And that stirs up strong emotions and doesn't help your your final journey, so to speak. Okay. And also, they can't accompany you. So it's one of those moments in life. There are moments in life where we have to face them alone. First, we become alone. Even if we come as a twin, you know, right? And death, you go alone. Even you are surrounded with lots of dying people, you have your own individual experience. So it's not something that another person can accompany you. Okay. So, and the third point, even our own body cannot help you at the point of dying. So it is precisely our body that is giving up on us. Our body is saying goodbye. And depending on the cause of death, certain illness, you can literally physically see your own body breaking down, you know, before you, while you're still alive. So the body is dying. So the body is of no help to you on death. And hence, this last 3 points highlight the importance of having some kind of spiritual practice, having some kind of spiritual understanding, so that death will come forth to support you at the moment of need. So that's what we covered through the 9-point meditation. So today I want to talk about, there's a meditation we also do related to death awareness, which is to simulate the dying process. To actually imagine going through the process of dissolution. So I want to explain that here, and to do a meditation on that. Usually when I present it, I also taught this meditation in a general meditation class, not under the topic of death and dying. When I do that, I don't tell them that they are dying, because I don't want them to get shocked. So I explain to them that this is a meditation that describes, you know, one view, one presentation of how our consciousness can change, going from a coarser level of operation to a more subtle level of operation. So the dissolution of coarser level of consciousness, so that more subtle level of consciousness can manifest. It's a little bit like falling asleep. You are awake, and then you go through a process, and eventually you are asleep. And in between, you can also experience dreaming. Dreaming is not as I don't know, all of us have dreamt before, right? But when you're dreaming, I always felt sometimes in the dream, hey, some part of my brain are not functioning. I felt like some of the reaction I have in the dream is a bit like repetitive, or I'm not thinking very clearly, you know, sometimes usually it has something to do with ad hoc. I was always running around the airport, looking for luggage, looking for passport, you know, full of anxiety. And yet there's this feeling that I'm doing something really stupid. You know, but of course sometimes I realize, oh, why am I in the airport? I was supposed to be in my bed, right? Why am I running around the airport? Then that would be a lucid dream, that you realize that you are dreaming while you are dreaming. But anyway, so you can think of waking state consciousness, dreaming consciousness, and consciousness and deep sleep, which for most of us we are completely unaware. And there's this shift from coarser level operation to a more subtle level. And this meditation is really talking about that. Of course, it happens when we fall asleep, and it also happens at the end of our life when we go from living to dying. Okay? And I want to just explain it a bit and describe it. And also, it's quite a good meditation if you don't hold too tightly to this idea of death. As a meditation that, for some people, they actually get very, help them to settle down. Because the meditation itself, there are 8 steps to it. So we sort of imagine going through 8 stages. And each stage is like we set things aside. We leave something behind. We let go of something. And we drop it from our mind, from our concern. So you, as you go down, as you go deeper, it's like you become lighter. there's less things to preoccupy you with. You just leave all your luggage behind. Don't worry about them. You know, you just start to unload all the things that are weighing on you. So when you finally come to the final stage, what's called the mind of clear light, you feel very, surprisingly, very subtle, very settled. You know? And you, quite often people feel, and they see, light behind them. Even with the eyes closed, they see the mind create some images of light. Yeah. And that's quite often a good sign, you know, because you are sufficiently settled for your visual cortex to, you know, to activate and just create some patterns of light. And that only happens when you are not agitated, you are quite at ease or at peace in your meditation. So it's a good technique also in general to help you to let go of things that preoccupy your mind and to shift to a more settled state. So I just want to describe these stages, and then we do a meditation, and then we can maybe discuss a bit of dying, death, and rebirth in the context of Buddhism. Have some of you heard about these 8 stages of dissolution of life? A show of hands, anybody heard of it? Okay, a few, very few. Okay. So in Tibetan Buddhist tradition, this is unique to Tibetan Buddhist tradition, it says that as we die, as we go from a waking state to sleep, we go through a series of shifts in consciousness. The first and the most coarse layer of consciousness is associated with the earth element. Earth is all the solid things. And so what happens is, in this dissolution, is that level of consciousness stops functioning. It stops basically dissipating, disintegrating. It ceases to function anymore. So as it ceases to function, then things associated with that level of consciousness, it disappears from your awareness. You're no longer aware of it. It's just conscious of it. It's gone with that level of consciousness. And what text is described a lot of changes physically and mentally, but I like to keep it simple. I think, well, it means that earth, or sometimes talk about form, the form aggregate, form are all the things that we see, all the sight, color, the shape. So I describe it as the furniture of your life. You know, the furniture, so that when you move into a new place, you can decorate your flat, your house. So we are preoccupied with form, shapes, and colors. These are the furnitures of your life. At this point, it's time to let them go. So the consciousness that is related to that is dissipating, dissolving. It's time to say goodbye. So you say goodbye not only to all the form, the colors, the shapes, the furnitures of your life, are all the solid things that we are associated with. Your antique, oh, my antique chest, I must carry it with me wherever I move. It's time to say sayonara. You have to let it go. Okay? I don't know who is landing, who will take possession of it, but it's not you. But you are dying. So you say goodbye to all these solid things in your life. And to mark the transition from this level to the next, it's as if in your mind there is a vision, an image will appear, you know, an omen of what is to come next. And this image, traditionally, it says it's a mirage. You know whether you've seen a mirage, you know, mirage like on a hot day, the road ahead of you, you see this shimmering image as if the sky is reflected on the road, as if it's very wet, right, this water. So it's a mirage. Mirage is as if there's water in front of you. So a mirage image appears in your mind, an omen of light. So earth dissolves, and the next element that becomes prominent is water element. The consciousness associated with water. So water is flowing. It's usually associated with feeling. Feeling of pleasure, feeling of pain, feeling of neutral feeling. So this is the level where all the feelings. So, all those feelings we have through an entire lifetime, times of great happiness, times of great suffering, you know, all those feelings disappear, you are saying goodbye. In a way, it's like they disappear from your awareness. You no longer remember that, you no longer aware of them. So all the ups and downs of one whole life, time to say goodbye. And that dissolves. And as that dissolves, another image appears in your mind, an image that you are in a room full of smoke, just lots and lots of smoke. So it's an omen when it comes. Water dissolves, smoke means there is a fire. So the next element that becomes prominent is fire element. Fire element, consciousness associated with fire. I will describe with you, so you don't have to memorize it, but I'll describe as fire. So as the fire element cools, fire is associated with energy, which is, in this case, with discernment, our ability, our energy to tell that this is this and that. And we can tell things apart, we can remember people, we can assign names to people. This is a time when all the names of all those people closest to you disappearing from your consciousness. You forgot about their name. And along with their name, you forgot about the different concerns and affairs of all these people that may have preoccupied you for the whole life. You know? So and so has done this and did that and it's like this or it's like that. You know, all those things along with their name disappearing from your consciousness. So that is a consciousness associated with fire element and that is dissolving. Everything is cooling down. All those passions, you know, energy of an entire lifetime, all cooling down. And then in the transition, another image arises. And that image is as if in a very dark night, you know, someone has lit a bonfire, and you see all these sparks, fire sparks flying against the darkness. What does it mean? It means there's wind. You know, the wind blow on top of light, fire, and that's where it lifts up all these fire sparks. So the next element is wind, air element. So consciousness associated with air element is dissolving. And this is the point where when you're dying, the physical breath starts to get weaker and weaker and eventually stops. Okay? So air element stops. What is air element associated with? Activity. Movement activity. So a whole life of preoccupation is activity. Doing this, doing that. Rushing here, rushing there. Need to get this done, need to get that done. All that disappears. It disappears from your awareness, say goodbye to you. That's it. That's the end of it. So this four is so-called cause consciousness. They're all associated with something physical in our life. Or the, especially the outer things, the furniture, the different feelings you have at the different occasions in life, the people, the name, the affairs, and all your activities. You know, or your achievements, or your failures, all of that, you know, up to this point, you will say goodbye, and they disappear from your awareness. Okay? So at that transition, another transition is like a dying flame, like a candle, and the flame is flickering, it's dying. And being a chemist myself in training, it's like it's running out of oxygen. And eventually the flame dies, disappears. That ends. So at that point, marks physical death in the clinical sense. It's an actual breath stop. So in Tibetan Buddhism, even though the body stops breathing, it's still not considered death. Even though clinically, maybe as the breath stops, then maybe the heart, the brain, the stuff, function. But as far as Tibetan Buddhism is concerned, you're still not dead. There's still a process. There's still some, so the external process may have stopped, but there are some inner mental process still happening. And that is the next four stages, which are entirely inner. You're no longer, you're in a way like cut off from the outer world, the world of sight and sound and smell and body, or the links cut. So only some inner process happening. And there is sometimes the three visions. So it's like in your mind, the first vision is like, okay, the mind is like the sky, right? And the sky filled with radiant white light. Right? But nothing, no form, it's just light, it's just radiant white space. Sometimes I, usually they use the moon, but I like to think of it as like a noon day. No, at noon time in Singapore, noon time. Very, very bright, the sun is very bright. So it's without the heat, okay? Forget about the thing about heat. Okay? the brightness is like, you know, fill up the entire space of your mind with white light. Okay? It's the white vision. So it's like the, I use this image. It's the sun of your awareness. The inner awareness is setting. And finally, so it's finally, you know, the function is finally finishing. Yeah. So white light gives rise to the redness of sunset. Like your awareness is, you know, like the sun setting behind the horizon, and the sky of your mind is filled with radiant red light. Okay, so that's the second vision. And then after it sets, the third vision is pitch black darkness. So in your mind, it's like absolutely nothing appears, just darkness, complete darkness. And here, you wait. You wait for the new dawn. So that would be the final stage, sometimes called the mind of clear light. So it's like, after what is the solution? The final, the most subtle level of your consciousness function, and there is an awakening. But the mind is, there's light in the mind. And there's a light, but this light has no color. It's just, you need to use your imagination. It's like awakening into a very simple state of mind, radiant, but no color. And also in this state of mind, there are no thoughts, no attachment, no anger, no worry. That's very simple state of awareness. And that is the mind of Kela. That's the most subtle level of consciousness that manifests at the time of death. Okay? That's the dissolution process. Beyond this, and this is the state where you read about some articles that have been published about how some Tibetan Lama or meditator, you know, even after physical death, all the vital signs have stopped, the body still remains fresh. You know? And people, Tibetans, they tend to keep the body on the bed or untouched for an extended period of time. Like 7 days, 10 days, 14 days. And people will report that there's no smell coming from the body. If you look at the body still looks like they're asleep, not like they're dead. So then, according to the tradition, this Lama or this meditator is in this clear light of death, this meditation on the clear light of death, and they remain in that state for an extended period of time. When that finished, then physical death, an actual death happens. That's when the consciousness is no longer associated with the body. So the body is the dead body. Before that, there's still the link between consciousness and body remains. Therefore, sometimes people still feel that although they're not breathing, they're somehow still there with the body. The body is not a corpse. I don't know whether it's true or not, but anyway. Yeah. Because I also hear other funny stories. Okay. Then I have this translator friend who says that, oh, last time he was serving this Lama and the Lama died. And because according to tradition, they had to keep the body there for 3 days without moving it, right? Supposedly, the Lama is in clear-light meditation, and that most probably not, because they had to burn a lot of incense, because the Lama's body is really, really smelly. Really, really smelly, but they can't tell the devotees that, I don't think the Lama is here anymore. So they just keep burning the incense, no? And mask the smell, and just allow people to come over 3 days to pay respect. So, but secretly, you say, I think the Lama's meditation has finished a long time ago. Yeah. This is also another way that people try to gauge the spiritual attainment of the Lama. Right? So if you stay in that state longer, you must be, wow, something, someone special. Right? Anyway, this beside the point. Okay, so roughly these eight stages, usually when I guide this meditation, I just describe it, and just go along with it. Right? So don't worry about, don't worry too much. If you can visualize that, whatever visual images come to mind, that's fine. If not, then you just think of it. Just go along with it. It's just like going one stage to another. Going deeper down from quarter level of consciousness to very subtle level of consciousness. So before I start, any question about this? Yeah. It doesn't go anywhere, but it's like the most bottom basement of our mind. No, and we normally don't notice it, but at the time of death, when you clear all your upper level and you find yourself in the basement of your existence, and you say, oh, no, there isn't anything here. No, it's clear. No? So that, but then as you come back to life or in the next life, yeah, then you come out of your basement and you start getting engaged in all the, you take a lift up, right, then you go higher up, then you have more and more activities, and then you get caught up in them. And so you are unaware of your basement. Does it make sense? After this, it begins the, what's called intermediate state. So we'll talk about it. But that is the demarcation point. After the clear light of that, what comes after is when the consciousness become separate from the body. And so that is counted as the stage in between lives. This life is finished. It's finished. Yes. Similar stages, yeah. About what? No, you go through the whole thing, but it's not as complete as the time of death. So you have what they call clear light of sleep. So you actually could achieve a similitude of experience of clear light. Yeah. But what it means is that you don't cut all your linkages, so you didn't actually die. But as you go down that eighth level, your consciousness also shift, also change. So the association with the different levels, dissolution also happens with the different levels. It's like when you are asleep, you don't think about anything, right? You're not concerned about anything. Nothing comes to mind, right? Yeah. So the same, similar kind of dissolution process, according to the tradition. Yeah. You must not confuse sleep with dying, even if the dying happened in the sleep. The dying happened in the sleep means it goes through another series of dissolution, which is the dissolution of dying. The dissolution of sleep is different from the dissolution of dying. Yeah. So, but don't scare people. No? People always like dying in the sleep. It's not that easy to die in your sleep. Right? So you go down, when you go to deep sleep, then when you wake up, think positively, you will wake up, you ascend this whole series. It can happen very fast, right? Can ascend very fast. Then you again reconnect with the sight and the sound, your senses, what's happening, then you are awake. The functioning of your consciousness. No, it's not. In fact, in Buddhism, consciousness is a very impermanent phenomenon. It always changes. That's why it undergo all these changes and change again, and so it doesn't. It's not a lump of things. So later, if we have time, we can talk about what happens when we die, when we're dead. Is there a lump of things that you sort of throw out of this body and into another body, or what happens? Actually, most people think in that way, which has to do with our natural sense to make things concrete. And also it doesn't help with all these movies, you know, the movie like, you know, like Three Lives, that this Chinese movie, you know, it's all very romantic. This life you cannot make it together, then another life you try again, then another life you finally make it. You always use the same actor. Otherwise you don't know, right? You don't know who is the reincarnation of who, right? But the reality, of course, is, the Buddhist version is much more tragic, right? You know, one guy is human and the other one born as a dog, and then what are you going to do, right? So you always miss one another, you know? Then there's this funny story in Buddhism of how, at one point, Shariputra, this disciple of the Buddha, was looking into a courtyard. I don't know whether it's true or not. Then he saw a family, the father, the mother, a baby, and a dog that they are mistreating, and they are, I think, barbecuing a fish or something like that. And all these five people are connected in the previous life. So the baby that they are cherishing is actually their worst enemy. You know, before in its previous life, it was their worst enemy. And I think the fish is the father that they are barbecuing, and the dog is their mother that they are mistreating. See, so this is the Buddhist version. It's always very tragic, you know, like a bit like. So Shariputra was saying how absurd is this whole idea of cyclic existence. That in one life it can be your worst enemy, and the next life can become your most cherished person. You know, or in one life this is the one that you swear, you know, so on to love, and the next life is your someone that you mistreat. So there is nothing certain in this transition from one life to another. They don't make it into a movie or a drama. It doesn't help with rating, so they don't do it. Okay? Alright, so let's do a meditation together. And not to worry if you fall asleep, you just tell yourself you are experiencing the clear light of sleep. The actual clear light of sleep. So I'll guide you, and not to worry, and you just go along and see what happens. Alright, so take a few moments and just settle your body in a posture that you feel comfortable and supportive of your body, one that doesn't cause unnecessary pain and discomfort to your body. And most important, see if you can allow the back, the spine, to be upright in a natural way without the need to tense up your back muscles. So rest your hands on your knees, or you can place one on top of the other and rest them in your lap. And feel free to close your eyes completely in this meditation. At any point of time, if you feel get very confused or meditation is a bit disturbing to you, then feel free to open your eyes just to reorientate yourself. And when you feel ready, you can close your eyes and rejoin the meditation. So take a few moments and let your body settle into the meditation posture. We can really become aware of sensations beneath you at the point of contact between your body and your feet, your body and the ground. Really feel that your body is resting on something solid, firm, stable. Qualities we associate with the earth, the ground, they are here to support your body, to pull you up, to keep your body well balanced. So imagine that your body can automatically begin a process of just loosening up, unwinding. You can release unnecessary tension and tightness in the body. Let's take a few moments to help our body and mind to settle down, to settle into meditation, to make that transition. And a good way to do that is to make use of the breath. To see if you can return your attention and become aware of the breath sensations in the body. And just allow yourself to experience your in-breath and your out-breath. see if you can try not to control the breath. Just allow the breath to flow naturally. The breath may be long or short, maybe deep, shallow, maybe slow or fast. Just allow your body to breathe itself. And just become aware of that wavelength movement of the breath in your body. Flowing in and out, rising, falling, expanding, contracting. And for a few moments, see if you can pay special attention to your out-breath, breathing out. Remind yourself, your body and mind, with the word release in your mind. Breathe out and release. Not to worry what you are releasing, but just take this opportunity with each out-breath to release anything unwanted, unhelpful, unnecessary to the meditation. Maybe as you breathe out, some of those tensions in your face, temperature, tensing of the muscles of your forehead, some of those in the jaw, those around the eyes, maybe some of those tensions may flow away with the breath. Allowing your face to feel softer, more relaxed, more comfortable. Coming back to your out-breath, you will get distracted. And as you breathe out, remind yourself with the word release. Release your body and mind into the posture, into the meditation. And I'm going to guide you through this dissolution of consciousness, which is also meditation on releasing. Release the different things that preoccupy your mind. Release the wholesome functions or operations of your consciousness. Allow them to dissolve away, to disappear. Starting with consciousness associated with earth element. Earth element, form element, things, the shapes, the colors, like all the furniture in your life, maybe literally the furniture and your home, all the solid things, the structure, the order in your life. Things that preoccupy your mind. Things that they're saying goodbye to you. Or they are saying goodbye to you. Earth element is dissolving, disappearing, fading away. Release them from your mind. Release your concern about them. Concern about material possessions, material things. Let them disappear. In your mind's eye, a vision appears, an omen of light to come. You see, you imagine seeing a mirage, shimmering mirage, as if there's water in this pretty sun. That element is dissolving. Earth element has dissolved, water element becomes prominent. Water, flowing, wetness. Water element is dissolving, it's drying up. And water is associated with feelings. So all the feelings that preoccupy you, feeling of pleasure, happy feeling, unhappy feeling, feeling of pain, of sadness, all the ups and downs, all those feelings are saying goodbye, disappearing, dissolving away. Water element is dissolving. Imagine as if all the feelings that you may be preoccupied with in an entire life, you know, forgetting about them, is disappearing from your mind. Another vision appears in your mind, an omen wants to come. Imagine you are in a room filled with thick smoke, nothing but smoke, everywhere. Water element is dissolving, saying goodbye. The water is dissolved. Fire element becomes prominent. You become aware of the warmth within your body. Fire element related to passion, related to our perception. The people in our life, the name, the affairs, all of this you are forgetting, saying goodbye to them, they're disappearing. Everything is cooling down. Fire element is dissolving. In your mind's eye, another vision appears. You see again the dark sky, fire sparks flying everywhere. An omen might come. Fire element is dissolved. Air or wind elements become prominent. Notice your breath. Going in and out. Now the air element is dissolving. The breath is saying goodbye. Alongside with it, all the activities you are preoccupied with in this life, the busyness of life, doing this, doing that, going here, going there. All of this inclined towards stillness that coming to an end. All activities stopping, you're forgetting, you're saying goodbye to them. Air element is dissolving. In your mind's eye, another vision, a tender flame, flickering, going out as the oxygen, as the air is exhausted. The flame becomes smaller and smaller, and finally disappears. And with that, imagine all your course consciousness is dissolved, your link with physical reality is cut, the outer breath has stopped, and the inner mental experience remains. In your mind's eye, imagine another vision. The mind's space is filled with clear white light, where the sun at noontime, bright, radiant, white in color, without the heat, just radiant white light. The sun of your consciousness, your awareness is setting. It's fading away, disappearing. The sun at noontime gave way to the sun at sunset. The space of your mind is now filled with radiant red light. And then imagine the sun of your awareness has set beyond the horizon. The pitch black darkness descends on your mind. Everything disappears except that darkness. And in that darkness, you rest, you wait. Imagine in the darkness a new dawn arrives, a different light appears, a clear light, without color, its radiance, its brightness, you know, awakening into your clear light mind. Radiance, luminance, awake, less simple, not preoccupied with anything, not thinking about anything. It's rest. In the clear light mind, open spacious awareness. And as you rest in your clear light mind, thoughts and mind, let them go, let them dissolve back into the mind. Just try to be relaxed and rest in this simple awareness. When you feel ready, allow yourself to come back to life, become aware of the body, the sound. When you feel ready, you can open your eyes, come back to life. Anyway, so quite often when I do this meditation, even though it seems very busy, this is all. Yet usually when I come to the last part, the mind is relatively speaking a lot more calmer, at least for me. Yeah. Suddenly there's not so much thought. Because of course I didn't die, right? So I can notice, it's like, it's just aware, maybe aware of the darkness of my mind. Maybe sometimes I can be aware of little sound, little sensation. Very simple mind, not so busy, but not like, so almost like, actually just by imagining the dissolution process, I managed to put aside a bit of the things that preoccupied myself, just by sending my mind, even just by imagining going through the dissolution, saying goodbye to earth, water, fire, air, and so on. So this is one way to meditate on the dying process. And according to Tibetan Buddhism, this actually happens when we lie there dying. So if I continue, any questions? Yes. Yeah, very fast. Especially if the physical body is damaged or destroyed, then this process will go super fast. Because actually the process is the process of cutting the connection of so-called consciousness with the physical body. not cutting, but like, you know, the first four is like the association with the physical body is being withdrawn, they stop functioning. So, in a more elaborate description, the senses also gradually stop functioning, like eye sense stop functioning, so you can't see anymore, then you can't hear, and then you cannot smell, taste, and eventually you can't even feel your body. So the connection between consciousness and body is gradually been cut, until you left behind is just pure inner mental functioning, and that also eventually disappears. And that's when the link between consciousness and the body is completely cut, and what is left behind on the bed or whatever is just a big corpse, it's a corpse, just a physical matter with no longer any conscious activity. So that's why the dissolution process still happens if death is very sudden, very like you get blown apart or whatever. But it says that it will be very much condensed into a split second. Tell them.
Shut up.
Tell them don't visit me. But some people choose. They all went for Kopitiam too. You know, they went and went and you still didn't die, right? And then they get tired or hungry and they all went down to eat and then choose the right time to die. Some people, their story, right? You know, people, they rush back and they hang around and they didn't die, right? And the moment you went out for a toilet break, and then they expired. That's a good time to go. Yeah. I don't think we have control over it, so not to be too concerned. But if you have an opportunity, you can explain sometimes that it doesn't help to cry next to someone. I mean, if you want to cry, of course you can, but you know, it can be very upsetting for the dying person, especially if they can hear. You know. Also, they don't want you to be sad, right? You know. So it's good to, when you're with the dying person, it's good to project something positive, reassuring, saying that you know, we'll be fine. You may be crying, trying to cry outside, but if next to the bed or the person, you can say, no, please feel free to go. You know, everything will be fine. That's the Buddhist idea. Yeah. 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 When you're in a coma, there are certain conscious activities. Yeah. So I don't know whether you can actually match it with the dying process. Because when you're in a coma, you're not dying, right? It's just that you have a diminished kind of conscious activity. Certain things are not functioning, but there are other things. So strictly speaking, you're not dying, or like in a vegetative state, right? So certain function, brain function may no longer function because the brain is damaged, right? But that person is still, but actually coma and vegetative, then a lot of them are not, they're not ventilated. They breathe themselves. It's just that they don't show very obvious conscious kind of response. I know because my mom was in a vegetative state for 3 years, right? She's not on any life support at all, but she did lie there. And she had waking and sleeping cycle, you know, and she can yawn, and she has very basic reflex, but she doesn't respond to conversation or anything, right? So she has diminished conscious activity, but she's not like dying. Okay? So I don't think these 8 stages of dissolution apply to her. It's just that maybe on the causal level, certain functions are no longer available because of stroke, severe brain damage. But if you look at her, if you don't know, she looks like when she's asleep, she snores. So she's asleep. Right? And you can't know that she wake up. But she doesn't show any other conscious activity. I don't know whether she thinks. At the early stages, she actually cries. Cries for no other reason. It's very distressing because you know why she's crying. 就是 crying, like really sad like that. Then you wonder whether she's aware of her situation or not. And the solution is very bizarre. The doctor says, or you take some water or something and just to put in her mouth, you know, and then she stopped crying. It's almost like she has this reflex, you know, like she's hungry or something like she wanted food or something in the mouth, and just by putting something in her mouth, she cannot swallow. She just wet her mouth and then it calms her down and she stopped crying. So she's certain level of activity and response to the environment, but supposedly not to have any higher function of consciousness, like thinking and this kind of thing. I don't know. It's impossible to tell. So I think in those stages or in states or in a coma, they are in a reduced level of coarse consciousness. So not in a subtle or very subtle, because they are not dying. But of course, when the body breaks down and they die, then they complete that whole process of dissolution according to this scheme. Am I making some sense? Yeah. You probably have some after a certain process, after a certain level, and then stop. Then when you turn off the ventilator, then you complete that process of dying, of actual separation of consciousness from the body. I'm just guessing. Because I think if you measure this EEG, then you can tell that so long as you keep the oxygen going, maybe there are certain activity, but maybe there are also other activities that have already ceased. But it's no longer, I'm sure it has to be, because otherwise they won't switch off the machine. The brain must be, to some extent, dead or irreversibly damaged. So, yeah, but it's very hard to correlate this kind of clinical situation with the actual description of dissolution, because it would be just guessing, you know, whether they've gone through the earth element or the water element, so it's hard to say. Fire and it's not so much the water is cooling down. Water is so that's why I didn't. Water is movement, like flowing of feelings. Yeah, and fire element is actually related to this ability called discrimination or discernment. That's when I look at the face and I attach a name to it. I discern. I can tell one person from another. I tell one object from another, and I can tell that with this person, there's all these affairs, all these happenings associated with the person, to whom we attach a certain name, right? Like, you know, this is my brother, or whoever, and then all these things. So that is essentially the function of what sometimes we call discrimination or perception. So one is function of feeling, one is function of discrimination. So you just have to figure out a way to work for you. I think that's why you don't think of water as cooling. Don't emphasize the cooling aspect, which is, I mean, just think of hot water, I suppose. Water is just wet and like clingy kind of flowing kind of nature. But our feelings sometimes are a bit sticky, you know, and we hold on to things, we have sentimental value, we bring forth poignancy, we trigger certain feelings. So that function of feeling is fading away. You actually become more clear-headed. But the feeling goes, right? Then what left behind is this Like when you're very emotional, you feel all the feelings, right? Then when the emotions cool down, then you can think clearly. You get so something like thinking that way. So as the water evaporates, okay? Then evaporate means there's heat, right? The next thing to come is warmth, the fire element. The fire energy is discriminates. You know? I mean, just roughly, just metaphor. Okay? Think about it. Any other questions? Yes. Disappeared, yeah. Mm. We switch off the player. We've been longing to switch it off. I don't know. Technically, as the dying process progresses, you lose contact with the external environment. Right? It doesn't matter what you say or broadcast, right? But I think you would say for the living rather than for the dead. No? Or Namo Ami. Or no, that is the living feels we are in a sacred space. So they feel more consoled. A lot of things we do related to death is for the living as opposed to for the dead, right? So maybe we can think of it that way. Okay, so just to so in Buddhism, we say that death is not kind of annihilation. So Buddhists have this idea of rebirth. It's not like death is the end point. But actually, it's not so dramatic because in Buddhism we talk about there's a continuity. Right? So the physical body, when we came into this life, we start off as an embryo, right? And it is through the nutrients from our mother's womb that we develop into a baby, right? And then when we're born and then we consume, then we build up, right? We grow, okay? So there's that continuity, and that continuity does not stop at the point of death physically. So when we are dead, we have a corpse, right? The corpse is still the physical material, right? You know, the next stage is either you bury it or you cremate. This stage is cremate, right? So there is still a continuity to the physical material. So it goes from flesh and bone into ashes, into energy, into smoke, right? And then you bury the ashes, you scatter it, and so your physical element returns to the environment. So there is the cycle is not broken, it's continued. When we are born, we receive the elements from the environment, like first through the mother's womb, then through the milk, then through all the food, you know. So, and then at the time of death, this body will return to the environment, depending on how you treat it. So the cycle is not broken. It's a continuity of the physical element. And likewise, the continuity of consciousness according to Buddhism is not broken either. Right? So the last moment of consciousness of this life become a cause for the next moment of consciousness. And in this case, after the clear death, we enter what is called in the Tibetan Buddhist context, the in-between state, or the intermediate state, the in-between lives, one life to another. And this is where there's a lot of different theories about this. So, and you acquire a kind of a ghost-like body. Yeah, I don't know about this. But, so, and then you wander in this, wander around in this in-between state, a maximum, according to this tradition, maximum 49 days, looking for the next resident. Location. Not that you have any choice, it's like you're blown away by the wind of karma, and you get lodged into a new body. When that happens, the end of the intermediate state and the beginning of a new life. And this, throughout this so-called period, the consciousness continues. there's a continuity of consciousness. But it's not the same consciousness. It's like one moment of consciousness gives rise to the next moment, gives rise to the next moment, gives rise to the next moment. So consciousness is still constantly changing. Hence, technically, the more accurate way of describing the relationship between one life and the next is to say that the person of this life is not identical to the person of the next life. It's not identical, right? Because this life I'm a human, the next life I could be a dog. I always use this example. I most probably will be reborn as a dog. Right? So I always say, so this life I'm human. If I'm reborn next life as a dog, right? You cannot say that it is identical. One life is human, next life is dog. So one life and the next life are not the same. But they are not unrelated. It's not like they have no relationship, because there is a kind of continuity of consciousness. So that's how we technically accurate way of describing it. But most people don't think like this. Most of us, we have the idea, we tend to think of consciousness as something permanent and unchanging, like a lump of things, like this ball. You know. So this life finish, like some thing done or something like that. It comes out of you and you chunk it onto the next body, right? Also, it's common to think in that way because we cling to identity. We want to be immortal, right? We don't really want to die, right? We don't want change. So that's why we tend to feel that this life and the next life are the same. The body may be different, but it's still me. Okay? That's how we tend to think. But technically, that's not quite accurate. And a simple way to prove it is when you're born, right, do you feel that you are someone else? No, right? You think that we're all very self-centered, okay? Promise you. We think that this is my life. And the one before is my past life. And the one to come next is my future life, right? So I guarantee you, your next life will also be the same. That person in your next life will have forgotten about you. Because you are the footnote to his or her life, right? His or her will say, my life, and you will be like, my past, their past life, okay? And they will say, you won't think about your hopes and your fears and your aspirations. They will say, hey, how come you didn't do better? You should create more merit so that they get to have a better life. They may blame you for their misfortune, and they will forget about you for their good fortune. Okay? So I think quite often we see depicted in movies or dramas this reincarnation and rebirth. The idea of remaining unchanged from one life to another. Sometimes even with the same actor, right, looks the same also, right? it's not realistic. It's not the, it's actually, from Buddhism, it's a manifestation of our deepest delusion, our sense of, things holding together, remain unchanged from one life to another. And that is not really like that. Okay. Does it make sense? So there is, yeah. It doesn't disappear. Yeah. So, most Buddhists belong to philosophically what they call, a dualist, substance dualist. They think that there are two types of substance. One is matter, material thing, and the other one is this mysterious thing called consciousness. And there are two different stuff, basically. Right? So, life, when we are alive, consciousness is associated with the body, this body, and when we die, they separate, right? And this stream of consciousness is associated with another body. So, at any one point of time, there are these two stuff. Right? So, whether this is true or not, I don't know, we can debate philosophically. But most of the thing in this way. So that stream of consciousness changes, but doesn't, it's not cut. That's not it. In this context,
because the population is growing, right?
Yeah. Consciousness, yeah. Maybe more mosquitoes are reborn as humans, yeah. So, So that is a tricky one, you know, where are the extra conscious stream of consciousness, where do they come from? Yeah. Or if you have a population decrease, then what happens to those extra stream of consciousness? So they like to think that, they like to say, well, you know, they can come from other parts of the universe, not confined to planet Earth. Yeah. That's another way. Although most in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we always joke, most in reincarnation are Tibetan. Right? There's a few Westerners, so Caucasian and maybe a few Chinese, but they're all Tibetan. In fact, not only Tibetan, they are like the son of the nephew of the Lama. You know? It's like within the same family somehow. They're like, shouldn't there be more choices available, right? Why within the same village or sometimes within the same family? The brother is the reincarnation of this Lama, and then the next brother is the reincarnation of that Lama, and the sister, you know? So all gathered together in one family. You know, they say, you give other people, other places a chance, right? You know? Maybe you can take rebirth a bit further away from your, I'm just joking. So, but yeah, so usually they explain that, so technically they cannot increase the number of consciousness. So it must come from some place. Okay, so with that, we cover a bit of this presentation of appreciating our life and death. And hopefully, it's helpful for you. And the most important thing is when, even just to listen, even if you don't meditate or think about it, it's good to be exposed to the idea to sort of place it in our awareness. And I really find that over time, even just to be open to think about it and to be more aware of it, is a good preparation, you know, for death, because it can happen in all sorts of ways, not necessarily must be to you, but around you, and you will find that this awareness, you know, or knowledge can be very supportive at those times. No, it doesn't, but I think it reduces my grief, my sense of loss and grief. Or it doesn't actually reduce, but what I mean is the feelings, all the feelings that have been triggered or fear is placed in a context. It has a current context, so it, they are understandable. They don't feel like alien, like I've been assaulted by something, some great tragedy. They are still painful, but they seem to, they make sense, basically. You know, it's not like something senseless that I'm being wet with, but it's like, it's painful, but it's, I can understand it. I can, sort of, in the scheme of things, there is a place for it. I can, it's normal. It's still difficult to deal with the losses and the grief, but, it doesn't feel so out of place. And so therefore, what I find is that it allowed the grief to run its course and come to an end. It allowed, there's a place to appreciate loss and the pain, you know, and because they are meaningful, they make sense, that happens to every one of us. And then, therefore, allowed the emotions to arise. So there's no, when things are, you cannot make sense of it, you can't understand it, or it's a shock, you have not been prepared for it. And not only do you have those emotions, but they linger. You kind of get stuck because you don't know how to move on. So that's where the greatest suffering is. You experience loss, you experience grief, and yet you have never thought about it. So in your mind, you are not prepared for it and not able to reconcile with it, and therefore the grief sort of linger on and on, and the pain just keep coming, and that is great suffering. Whereas if you can make sense of it, you say, yes, this is normal, and this is what is supposed to happen, I don't like it, but you know, it happens, then you allow feelings to come and feelings to go. And then I find that was really, really helpful. Okay. So thank you very much for your attention. We are having a break for 2 weeks because of Vaisak celebration. The big tent is already up. So please support the center by visiting the tent it's very hot. I know. Just visit the tent during the weekend. So this is to, I think, someone is preparing to clean the silverware already for the Visak celebration. Okay. So we stopped. They won't have classes. One is for preparation, and the other one is for the poor volunteers and office staff to have time to rest. Yeah. So for 2 weeks, then after that, we start again a new series, a new topic on protection from refuge and karma. So we're going to move on to a new topic. Right. Thank you very much for your attention, and have a good week.